So while this is loading, some of my colleagues are passing around a brief survey that would help us out if you fill us out, so we greatly appreciate that. We just heard from the results from some places that have progressive policies that have led to amazing consequences in this population that we care about. I'm unfortunately here to talk about what happens when that doesn't occur and some of the things that you can do if you find yourself in that situation. So my name is Kyle Barber. I'm a medical student at the University of California, Irvine, but more germane to this talk, I'm a needle exchange activist in Southern California. And no one makes money in needle exchange, so neither did I. So briefly, the reason that I'm talking to you is I work in Orange County. Orange County has over 3 million people in it. It's the sixth largest county in the United States. We have an utter failure in our county to provide social services to the most vulnerable among us. For example, even though we have over 3 million people in our county, we have no permanent homeless shelter. We have very few harm reduction services. There's no needle exchange. And we have been working very hard to fill that gap. To give you some context of what this looks like, prevalence of HIV in the place where we're working at is about 16% among IDUs, so much higher than the national average. And of course, hepatitis C rates are absolutely appalling. So what I want to talk about here is not the data behind needle exchange or why needle exchange is important. Hopefully, you already know that. Or broad strategic decisions that you need to make as an activist in order to have a successful program, but more of when you find yourself in an environment where there's a huge amount of hostility directed toward your program and there's a huge amount of hostility directed to the people that you love in the street who are dying of HIV and hepatitis C, what tactics you can use in order to implement successful programs when the infrastructure is not there to make it for you. So although this isn't a strategy talk, I do want to point those of you who might want to learn more about that to some of the resources that are out there. The Harm Reduction Coalition and the World Health Organization have two freely available excellent publications that are under 100 pages that describe about everything you could need to know about how to implement a needle exchange. They're available at the URLs there. They're phenomenal, and needle exchange is really simple. It's not something that requires a huge amount of expertise to do. Didn't mean to do that. And the other two documents that they have freely available, one is about take-home naloxone projects for heroin users, and the other is Getting Off Right, which is a bunch of harm reduction techniques both for clients of your program and for your caseworkers to know about. And it additionally has probably the best title of any public health publication I've ever seen. So these are things that you should know about and potentially use in your program. So tactic one, I think, is this, and it's something that we've had to learn the hard way, and many of you have learned as well, which is, we were threatened with arrest within 4 months of trying to start a program. The public health department in our area refuses to acknowledge that we exist, despite the fact that in their own public documents, establishing a needle exchange by 2015 was listed. For me, probably the most painful thing that I've learned as a medical professional is when those in power fail to stand up on behalf of people who are dying in the streets that we love, and when they have the ability to do so and allow your program to proceed. We as activists have to learn how to deal with that in order to continue moving forward, or we would be silenced by the failure of those in power who have the ability and fail to do so. So one of the things that we have learned and one of the things that has kept us going is that when that occurs, it gives us the moral courage to stand up for the people that we care about and that we work with every day, and leads people like me, who normally don't like doing this kind of thing, to stand up on behalf of those that we see dying of diseases that they don't need to die of. The other aspect is that it forces your program to be creative, and I think that that's important to recognize because creativity is required in such conditions. Germane to those issues is that we're trying to operate a legal above ground program, and in doing so, it's critically important that you find legal representation early. We were compelled to do that the first time that we were threatened with arrest, even though we hadn't done anything illegal and the things we were being threatened with weren't actually against the law. But it turns out that having legal representation is beneficial for many other things as well, because people take you more seriously, and it allows you to navigate the myriad bureaucratic hurdles that are put in your way as an activist to prevent you from operating, even though the public health evidence is on your side. So here are some of the many things that we've had to go through and that many of you may have had to go through. Being told that we had to comply with zoning laws for hospitals, despite the fact that we don't provide medical services. Being told that we had to obtain business licenses, despite the fact that we don't provide business services. The endless navigation of taxes and so on. The illegal arrests of our clients, which happen daily. And as happens in many other places in California, when you obtain needles or paraphernalia or naloxone or whatever from a needle exchange or from a physician, it's perfectly legal for you to have that, but the police don't recognize that or care. And so when you have lawyers, it allows you to fight for your clients, it allows you to fight for public health, and I wish we had realized that sooner, and my hope is that some of you who are trying to do this sort of work might learn from the mistakes that we made early on and don't repeat them. The way that we found that was through a collaboration with the UC Irvine School of Law Clinic. They've been absolutely phenomenal. It's a partnership between a couple of practicing lawyers in the law school and students who believe strongly in this sort of work. It's something that you should consider in your community if you don't have the money to pay for lawyers, which we certainly don't. If there aren't established clinics at a law school near you, we've had very, very positive support from Students for Sensible Drug Policy, which is a national organization that advocates for more reasonable drug laws, the Drug Policy Alliance, and the ACLU. Contacting these organizations might help you as an activist obtain the representation that you need to be successful. Additionally, I'm from San Francisco originally. San Francisco has a number of clinics that have lawyers in them that work for the benefit of the population that needle exchanges try to serve. You might find that collaborating with them, they might be willing to provide free services to you as sort of an extension of the services that they provide directly to clients. So those might be some ideas in terms of obtaining the legal support that you need in order to fight against the bureaucracy that's put in front of you to prevent you from helping people that you care about. Obtaining approval is the hardest part of this for us. Most places, at least in California, needle exchanges obtain their authority to operate through the local public health department. Like I said, our local public health department doesn't acknowledge that we exist, so that's not an option for us, and it's not an option for many other places where it's even worse than in Southern California, where people don't, there's no legal authority at all. So it can be great, but what do you do if this isn't an option? One thing you can do is you can go over their head. So we work with the California Department of Public Health, and one of the advantages of doing something like that is that, at least in theory, it's more isolated from the local politics that mire you. In theory, there can be formal structures that allow you to apply for some sort of official sanction that you as local activists can actually go through, rather than the complex chain of networking that is sort of prevalent in a local public health department that might not have a formal process for people not involved in that system to get involved. However, as we learned the hard way, bureaucracies are bureaucracies, and the politics go wherever you are, where they follow you in your activism, and so we were denied the first time around, mostly because the State Department didn't want to deal with the political heat that would have come from approving us. So that said, there are upsides to going through that process. Even though we were denied initially, it gave the California Department of Public Health the impetus to come down and help us negotiate with the police and with the local government in our area, which was hugely advantageous for us. So even though the denial was damaging, it might be worth considering sort of going over the head of the local authorities so that you can get some assistance from another body that believes in the mission that you're fighting for, if that makes sense. Another option, and this actively happens in some needle exchanges in California, is when there's just no way to get approved, you can work with people who don't need to get approved. So physicians, at least in California, can give as many needles as they want to whoever they want because they're doctors, and they don't need any approval from anybody to do that. So one thing that you can consider doing, and this may or may not be legal in your state, but is having an on-site physician and then giving out needles under their medical license. It has downsides. Physicians are notoriously busy. You might have to deal with malpractice and so on, but it has the advantage of you could open a clinic tomorrow as opposed to having to wade through years and years of activism. The final thing I want to talk about is what do you do now while you're engaged in that activism? And as all of you likely know, if you don't have clients who trust you and know that you will fight for them and know that you will speak what they know and speak on their behalf, you don't have a program. And so the building those relationships takes time. As the former panelist mentioned, there's a huge amount of distrust between doctors and injection drug users, and we need to breach that. So some of the things that you can consider doing is that, as this diagram you can see, every one of those rainbow stripes is a place that is a state that protects people who give out naloxone to opiate users from liability and makes it legal to do so, and so on. So one of the things you can be doing is working on overdose prevention, which at least in California and in many other places is much, much easier to do than operating a needle exchange, and that's in fact what we're doing right now. Other things that you can be doing is offering hepatitis C and HIV testing. You can be distributing other paraphernalia if it's legal. At the moment, a lot of the transmission of hepatitis C is through contaminated cottons and cookers as opposed to just the needles. So it's important to provide a full suite of harm reduction supplies, and you can be doing some of that and building those ties with injection drug users right now. Also, you can use this time to get very strongly acquainted with the data, because you're going to need to talk to people who don't believe you and who, as we've been told, think that drug users should die. And so you need to be able to have conversations with these people from a data-driven standpoint so that you can be believable and so that you can build a coalition. And so while you're doing all of the work that you need to do and get a program running, you can start that data process. And additionally, by building these connections, by doing things like this, you can collect the data that you need to collect in order to convince the local authorities that there's a real problem. We live in Orange County. Orange County is notoriously affluent. I can't tell you how many times people tell us that there's no HIV in Orange County, or that there's no hepatitis C in Orange County, there's no sex work in Orange County, and so on. So having the numbers and having the facts and having people who are willing to come and talk to the police with you about how their son died from MRSA because they used a contaminated needle can make the difference between operating and not operating. And so if there's any questions about – it's a short activist talk, but if there's any questions about tactics, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Yes, ma'am.
I'm just wondering how much the actual clients that you serve have been involved in the
action. Oh, thoroughly. So the reason that this program got started was actually because one of my colleagues who's sitting up front now was working with homeless people on a totally different problem and heard directly from organized homeless groups in Orange County that this was a needed service. And so they formed the backbone of our program from the very beginning. Our board consists of former sex workers and former injection drug users, as well as people like us who are, you know, medical people. And we meet regularly with our clients so that they form the backbone of our program. We very strongly believe that without our services being driven by the actual needs of people in the street and without the program directly advocating in their best interest and putting our own personal interests aside, that it will fail. So we feel very strongly about that. Sir?
A lot of places around the country, prescription opiate stuff is becoming very important.
Of course.
And I'm wondering, many of whom have some money,
Yeah, so that's a great question, and actually that's been really important for us. So two of our biggest allies have been sort of grief support groups in Orange County that were built from mothers whose children died almost universally from prescription opiates. There's a large population, as you probably know, of people who transition from prescription opiates into injection drugs. And so those families see that connection extremely clearly since they've experienced it. And we were involved with them from the very beginning. And in fact, our naloxone distribution program is done as a collaboration between us as needle exchange activists and them as sort of grief support groups. So we do engagement with homeless people primarily and sex workers because that's the people that we connect with, and they do a lot of connection with incarcerated people or formerly incarcerated people, people from the drug courts and families. So we sort of come at it from two different prongs in collaboration with them. So I think that that's very important. Sir?
Well done. I work in California with the Surgeon Chief Firm, and I used to the California Department of Public Health. Are there any other cities and counties that are going the route that you are,
Thank you for your work, and yes, there are. So we work very closely with activists in Riverside, since we're all Southern California brothers and sisters, and there are a number of people who are trying to go that route. It's my belief that unless that, you know, we have been really fighting very hard against the California Department of Public Health, trying to get them to approve us, and it's my feeling that if they don't approve us this time around, that they're going to kill their own program because they're going to lose credibility in the activist community. And so my hope is that they recognize that and allow us to get going and therefore open the door to get more syringe exchange going in other counties, because Riverside desperately needs one. As you probably know, 62% of California counties don't even have a program. So there's a desperate need to expand it, and if the California Department of Public Health doesn't do it, it's going to force all of us to go underground, and that's no good for anybody. So hopefully so, and please tell your colleagues to make it happen. Sir?
Has the Indiana outbreak loosened any minds?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer is yes. We try to make that connection. California really likes to think of itself as like a progressive blue state and therefore different than Indiana, even though our experience in Orange County has not been that. And so it's a little bit hard to bridge the gap ideologically, I think. I don't know if that makes sense. But people see, I think, as a consequence not just of the outbreak, but of all the activism that has come out of the outbreak and all of the research that's come out of the outbreak, that you need to have a comprehensive approach and that the problems of injection drug users rapidly spread into the community. And so it's not just those people that we don't care about. It's actually all of us. So there's a huge need for more people to speak out about that and more people to make sure that that message remains clear, but it has helped. Thank you very much.